This is Coastside Conversations. Guest today is Tabitha Allen, who is working with the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco and has a lot of background on using hotels and motels for helping the homeless people. And Tabitha, could you please start by just giving us a little bit of background about you and also about THC?
Sure. I have been working with people experiencing homelessness, for 20 some years now, starting at a homeless shelter in East Oakland, and then working with people that were getting released from incarceration, often into homelessness, not having housing. And then now currently in the place of providing permanent supportive housing, the other side of things, which is really great. And have been with Tenderloin Housing Clinic for 10 years now, providing both, I've worked in both the property management and the support services department here at Tenderloin Housing Clinic. And now I'm currently in the role of deputy director, more of an administrative role, but overseeing the operations from a higher level at Tenderloin Housing Clinic. We have, as an organization, been around for 40 years and originally provided advocacy for the residents of San Francisco. Our organization was really vital in fighting for the rights of San Francisco residents and making sure that there was fair housing, fair eviction practices, ordinances about heat, safety, to protect the people of San Francisco. And it wasn't until 1999 that we started providing housing, which is now the largest part of what we do. We do many different things, but the largest part of what we do is now permanent supportive housing.
And why did you transition to that? What was the motivation, do you know?
It was about need in the city and the city saying this is a direction that we want to go. These are, you know, services that we want to provide, and in communication with them, you know, asking if we would be willing and interested to try that out and step into that role. And we did. And in that first couple of years, we took on, I want to say, 5 buildings, and we have now grown to 22 buildings over the years.
Now, when you say buildings, are you talking about they were hotels, they were motels, things like that?
They are all single room occupancies. So yes, they were all hotels. At some point, we do have one apartment building that is studio apartments, but the rest of our buildings are single room occupancies.
And the city was kind of behind it. In other words, the city was basically saying, okay, guys, thank you for advocating housing. Now we need some, right? And you were saying, okay, we're willing to take this on. That must have been a big, steep learning curve. What was the first couple of years like?
You know, it's interesting. I wasn't here, so I can't really speak to the experience at that point. But certainly I know there was a lot of growth really fast within the organization, both in terms of the buildings that we were taking on and managing and the increase in staffing. You know, we have a fantastic leader that led us through that at the time and helped with that growth.
Can we say who that was?
Randy Shaw is our current executive director and was the leader at the time. He is the founder of Tenderloin Housing Clinic and was the leader at the time of that growth.
Okay. And I should just, for those who don't know, the Tenderloin is a very underserved, you know, full of need area within San Francisco. And it's right in the heart of town, and it's a very visible area and not that far away from the Civic Center. You know, I mean, it's very close to City Hall. So it's interesting that you guys were focused there. And I wonder, you know, are the housing units that are in these hotels all over the city? Are they concentrated in the downtown area? Where are they?
They tend to be all over the city. The majority of our buildings are in the Tenderloin. We do have some buildings south of Market, and we do have some buildings in the Mission District. I do think that there is a larger population, there's a larger group of buildings in this downtown area, but the buildings, the similar types of buildings exist throughout the city.
All right, so you were talking about the growth, suddenly had five buildings. Now you're taking on this big role of actually housing people. And then specifically, I suspect right from the beginning, supportive housing, right? In other words, putting people in touch with therapists or social workers or case managers, you know, describe that.
Yeah, we have been permanent supportive housing from the beginning, providing both property management and the support services component in-house. And we are a housing first organization. That is a model that we practice. And really what that means is we are low barrier housing, not requiring hoops for people to jump through, not having various things that people, criteria that people need to meet in order to be eligible for housing. We really don't have any eligibility criteria other than that you are homeless and that you're able to pay the rent. And then we have support services on site to help people maintain that housing.
Now, when you say able to pay the rent, what do you mean by that?
Well, in the majority of our buildings, rent is $500. We do have some buildings that currently have a subsidy attached to them, and tenants in those buildings pay 30% of their income, whatever that income is. But the rest of the buildings are not currently, though that is a direction the city of San Francisco is going, they currently are not subsidized. So people have to have some sort of stable income. Majority of our tenants are on public benefits like SSI or Social Security, CAP benefits, which is San Francisco's welfare program, general assistance program. I would say the majority of our clients have that as their source of income. Obviously, we still have people that are employed, have veterans benefits or unemployment benefits, other types of income as well.
Okay, so let's say that you've got a person who comes to you that is, I'm assuming these are single people generally, that you're taking care of?
Generally, we do have some couples that move into our buildings, but for the most part, and I think that that is attributed to the size of the units, for the most part it is single adults.
Okay, and so they come to you, they have been on the street, they, you know, have some benefits. What if they don't have benefits? They come to you and say, hey, I want to be here, but, you know, I can't afford the rent. Is there something you guys do?
We don't. So if it's one of the buildings in which there is a rent and your rent is not based on income, that is something that would take place prior to people coming to our housing, prior to being referred. San Francisco has a coordinated entry program, and as part of that, they have a problem-solving component, and as part of that, they would be connecting people to the resources they need so that they could become housed.
Okay.
That does change for the units where people pay 30% of their income. They don't have to have an income when they enter our building, and one of the goals of case management would be to connect them to benefits.
Okay. So just to move on to the issue we have here in San Mateo County, as I mentioned earlier, there is they're about to buy three motels. These aren't hotels, so they have outside entrances. They don't have inside entrances. I know that that brings up other issues. And when I was talking to your colleague, Winnie Tang, one of the things she mentioned is that there's an organization called Urban Alchemy that actually kind of provides security for the motels and a gateway for people to getting into their rooms and stuff like that. Are you familiar with any of that?
Yes, I am familiar with Urban Alchemy. You see them all over the city. They're becoming quite prominent in the area. While their services seem similar to security, they don't define themselves as security. It is really relationship-based, the work that they do. And they do certainly help to secure areas, but they do that by building relationship and through communication and not through any punitive or enforcement kind of way.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'd love to get a hold of one of those people and talk a little bit about this idea, because I like that it's not enforcement, it's not punitive, it's relationship oriented, which is great.
It's also very peer based as well. They're very intentional about employing people with lived experience that helps in terms of building that relationship.
That's awesome. And I think one of the things I want to mention to people is that you guys have a retirement plan. That's how I know about you. And that, you know, you have about, I want to say 300 people, I don't know for sure. And a lot of those people were formerly homeless. And so, you know, as they say, I'm trying to think who said it, but, you know, poverty just, you know, has nothing to do with character. It's just a lack of cash. And I think it's really important for people to know that, hey, there's a lot of homeless people out there that are competent and capable and wanting to move ahead, right?
Yes, that is true. And I think one of our, we focus on really being client-centered in the services that we provide, and it being about what that client's goals are, what their intentions are, and really making sure that we aren't creating goals for them that don't fit within where they want to go. And I do agree, we have, you know, many wonderful people that live within our buildings that the permanent supportive housing has helped them be really successful and become stable. We have people that have been housed for many, many years after having, you know, experience of being homeless, and then come to our buildings and remained housed 5, 10, 15, you know, 20 years. So having some sort of stability in a place to lay your head and a little extra additional support really goes a long way to support people.
That's awesome. Yeah, so I think what I'm trying to find out is, okay, San Mateo County, which is where we are located, I'm in Pescadero, California. Half Moon Bay is where they're considering buying these. I think that they're in the process of buying these hotels. There's a lot of angst. There's a lot of, oh no, feeling. Like, oh dear, what does this mean? Are we going to have a bunch of people wandering the streets around here, making our lives miserable? So what is it like around a place where people have been homeless and now they're housed? I would hope it's similar to other big buildings that house people, but I just want to hear it.
I would say in many ways it is similar to other big buildings, though I will say that just because you get a key and now become housed doesn't mean whatever struggles and things that you were working with automatically disappear. A large portion of our population in our buildings have substance use issues, have mental health issues, have a lot of physical ailments. Mm-hmm. And they are certainly working towards resolving that or, you know, getting to a more stable place. But just moving into a building doesn't change that.
Of course.
Or having housing doesn't change that. So that it doesn't mean that you won't see things like drug use or people where, you know, that are experiencing auditory hallucinations, clearly are struggling with mental health issues. I don't think it creates an unsafe situation in any way. I think because people have a closed door to go behind and a place where they don't have to maybe use substances on the street or don't have to consistently be out on the street, I think it does certainly decrease safety concerns. It doesn't decrease necessarily the visibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good to know. You know, one of the places that they're considering buying is actually right across the street from, you know, the mental health clinic and the medical clinic for San Mateo County in Half Moon Bay, and also the police department, as luck would have it. And, you know, all these city services, a lot of city services are in this complex kind of across the highway, actually. It's not a real highway. I mean, it has street lights and pedestrian crosswalks, but It's kind of right in downtown Half Moon Bay, if there is such a thing. And so, you know, people are concerned about, well, what's it going to look like? Now, I just want to know, so here's a situation where one of the places, Coastside Inn, is a motel, and it has its own entrance, and it's not next door to housing. I mean, housing is in the streets beyond it. What can those people expect? Can you tell me? The people who, you know, in Half Moon Bay, who don't live there but might drive through, what can they expect?
I don't expect that they would really notice anything different. They may notice more, you know, a few more people hanging out outside of the building, because you have to get out of your unit at some point. Those units can be really small and isolating and confining. But otherwise, I don't think that they will experience or see much of a difference.
Okay. And then on the supportive side, I suspect you guys or somebody is referring these people to the mental health treatment that they need, or the mental health treatment providers that they need, or to case managers and social workers that can get them benefits. But that's all kind of invisible, right? That's a conversation with somebody, and then they go to that place. And it's no different from anybody else who's going to, you know, get benefits of any other kind.
Agreed. Yes. I mean, that is, there will be case managers on site that will help make those connections, will get people the services that they need. But that would be the same in any apartment building that people would live in. You know, at this point, a lot of people that are not homeless have to access medical care, emotional support, mental health support, various types of support, and that wouldn't look any different.
Right.
Most of those services are going to take place at maybe the mental health clinic that you said was across the street, or the medical clinic that's across the street.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I guess what I want to hear at this point, if you have some stories, a story or two, of people who, you know, came in, they were homeless, had been homeless, but, you know, they've now had a stable life. And what was, you know, if you have a story, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I can think of, I could think of probably several stories. It would take me a moment, but one in particular is somebody that had years of experience being homeless and came into one of our permanent supportive housing buildings, was, you know, really successful. She stayed housed, with us for, I wish I had looked prior to this so I could tell you, but she stayed housed with us for many, many years, became a part of our board of directors, is still on our board of directors, and is a great voice representing the residents in our building. She has moved on to another type of housing within our portfolio of buildings that the city calls the Housing Ladder Program, which is an opportunity for people that don't need as much case management support, an opportunity for them to move into a more independent situation. They have a key to the front desk. There isn't a front desk clerk monitoring the buildings. There is an application process. In these buildings, different from what I said earlier about Housing First buildings, there is a criteria there is some eligibility criteria for the people moving into those buildings. Typically those buildings are slightly nicer. All of the units have a bathroom. So she has been able to move from supportive housing, no longer needed that case management support, moved into a housing ladder program, and continues to be on our board.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. And I, you know, I have met people who have been temporarily homeless. I remember a time in my life, you know, I was getting a divorce and it was a pretty messy one, and I had to do couch surfing. I mean, that's homelessness in a sense. And I think a lot of people have been there. And then you get on your feet somebody helps you out, you stay with them for a few months, and then you get on your feet. And I'm sure there's some people who make a quick transition who can work, but just, you know, lost their job, didn't have the rent, are on the streets, living in their car or something, and then a couple of or a few months of housing, and they're back on their feet. That must happen too.
It does. I would say because of the cost of housing in San Francisco, that isn't as frequent, but that's not because they aren't ready to move into, let's say, an apartment or some other type of housing. It's really more about the lack of affordable housing and lack of options for them to move into.
Mm-hmm. You know, if there was a housing ladder that really was open to everybody, that would be such a great thing. I mean, there's so many people who just need affordable housing. They have jobs, but they can't afford our ridiculous rents, right?
Yeah, I mean, even affordable housing in San Francisco is not affordable for many people. So that makes it challenging. And we certainly have people that would be very successful living in, you know, one bedroom apartment, but are just challenged by the cost of that.
Yeah.
You know, even though, again, saying that a lot of the people in our buildings are on a fixed income.
Yeah.
You could be on a fixed income, you know, receiving Social Security and SSI and be fully independent and not in need of permanent supportive housing. But if you're only making $950 a month, you are not going to be able to move into other housing.
Yeah, it's here. It's our location and the incredible price that you have to pay. And so one of the things I've noticed is, you know, a lot of people are doing share rentals. A lot of people are doing tiny houses. We even have a section or an area in the Pescadero area where there's a bunch of people who are living in trailers, you know, RVs. Mm-hmm. So RV parks have become kind of the affordable housing in many areas. But it's a housing ladder, as you say. You got to start somewhere. And then you can, once you have a house, once you have a place and an address, so many good things can happen. And one of the things that I want to go into a little bit is housing first means having an address. And I wonder if you could just describe for a minute why just having an address is such a big deal.
Yeah, I'll go back to my years of working in a homeless shelter. And part of my job was to help people experiencing homelessness get into permanent housing. And often when I would be referring people to housing, there would be a lot of criteria. If you have a history of substance use, you need to show that you've been clean and sober for 2 years and have documentation that you're going to some sort of treatment. If you have mental health issues, you need to show that you are in treatment for that and have been stable for quite a long time. All of these hoops that if I applied for an apartment, it would be nobody's business. They wouldn't ask me. Yeah. And as a person that is experiencing homelessness and on the streets, that's not something you are focusing on at that moment. Your primary goal is, I need a place to lay my head. I need a warm place. I need food. And I'm not thinking about the fact that even if my intent is, I no longer want to use substances. Even if that is my intent, at that moment, my primary focus is not going to 12-step meetings, keeping documentation, 2 years worth of documentation of those 12-step meetings so that I can show it when I need to move into housing. You have you're bouncing from place to place. Often your things are getting lost, your things are getting stolen, and you're just trying to keep yourself safe. So the idea is remove all of those barriers. People really do intend to want to work on themselves, but that isn't something they have the ability to do. It's just not realistic when you are homeless, living on the streets, couch surfing, not knowing from day to day where you're going to lay your head.
Mm-hmm. If you're doing a job application and you don't have an address, it's a huge disadvantage. Mm-hmm. But there's so many other things. I mean, if you don't have an address, how does a caseworker come and find you? Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't have an address, how does a mental health worker know where you are? You know, it's just so basic. It's so obvious when you think about it. You really have to have an address for any kind of services, any kind of mail, any kind of, like, if somebody's sending you a form, a check, anything. So, I really see the need to have a nice, warm, stable place to lay your head and to have an address.
The other part of that is hygiene, right? If you're going to look for a job or you're going to go to services here, there, the other, if you're going to feel good about showing up to see your counselor, your therapist, most people feel really stigmatized if they have not been able to take a shower. Right. And don't feel comfortable doing that. And so avoid a lot of services because of
Right. So you've had this experience of working with the homeless, that, you know, people who started out homeless, then they got housing, then they became stable. You've probably seen hundreds of people. What is the trajectory? How many people succeed in that? How many people just sort of fall through the cracks?
You know, one of the challenges is how you define success in that. Yeah. Is success, I have stayed housed for 2 years or 5 years? Is success, I have a stable income? Is success, I've been able to move into housing outside of permanent supportive housing? And we try to define success based on each individual client. And for many of them, success might be, I finally have a key, I have a place to live, and I'm going to stay here at Tenderloin Housing Clinic for the next 30 years and can be completely okay with that. It's hard to put a percentage around it, but, you know, like if I look at our retention rate, typically our retention rate in our buildings is somewhere in between 90% and 95%, meaning that people either stay housed for 1 year or longer or move into other permanent housing. And so I think that's a pretty good success.
Right. So you're saying about 90 and 95% of those people who first come in that first year, 90 to 95% of them do okay, get a key, starts being living a stable life in some way, either in that particular unit or back home or somewhere. That's huge right there. That's huge. So you've got a fairly small percentage of people who aren't going to make it. And then maybe they'll make it 2 years from now, but they're not going to make it right now. And I guess that's life, right? I mean, we can't all be in the same place on the trajectory of, let's call it upward bound. You know, we're all on a journey. So overall, I just want to get a sense in the city where you are. You seem like you guys have a very successful program. And how many people overall do you house in your buildings?
It is about 2,000.
Okay, that's a lot. And then how many people of that, I know that you hire some of those people for maintenance or building property management or anything. How many people of that do you have actually that you employ?
Hard to know. I mean, the people that both live in our housing and are employed with us is a low percentage. I couldn't even tell you, maybe 5%. But I also think there's a lot of our, I think we employ both our own residents, but residents of other nonprofit organizations that provide permanent supportive housing. And that would be a higher percentage. And I'm not sure what that is.
A lot of these people find ways to succeed through your organization, some of them through employment, others just through some sort of stability. Maybe another question is, how many people become employed, period? In other words, get some sort of job.
Mm-hmm. I again would say that is a fairly low percentage, but that all comes back to many of the people that we work with having some sort of disability and no longer seeking employment and having permanent Social Security benefits. You know, maybe they've been employed in the past and are in a place where they are just, that is not currently their goal. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have people that become employed, but it's a fairly low percentage.
Okay, so I'm getting a better picture than a lot of people are on fixed income because of a disability, mm-hmm. and they really can't work, which of course makes a lot of sense. If you can't work, it's really hard to have the money you need to get housing. What is the likely success or the benefit overall to a community for having an organization that provides supportive housing?
I will say that having supportive housing versus just affordable, you know, affordable housing or other types of housing does not typically come with any type of support. And so I would say really the benefit of having supportive housing allows people to be more successful in their housing, stay housed longer, maintain their housing, and work toward their goals.
Okay. Whereas people without supportive housing, you know, they could lose it because they don't have the support for mental health care, for physical health care, for, you know, the applying for benefits that they qualify for, whether it's disability or veterans benefits or whatever, right?
Yeah, I would say that there would likely be a higher eviction rate in buildings that in places that don't have the on-site support available to people that have previously experienced homelessness. And, you know, one of the things that I would just, even when people move out of our housing and move into an apartment, we really try to prepare them for life is going to be different in that space. Like if you miss a payment, miss a rent payment, your landlord is probably not going to allow you to set up a payment plan. If you get into a fight with a resident in your building, I don't know, do something. If you have a noise violation, your landlord isn't going to give you as much leeway as we might. So I think we are setting people up for failure in some ways, because if you've lived on the streets for 10 years, you've lived without constraints of rules, without the constraint of rules. You've lived without the practice of paying rent monthly. Right. Right. There's a lot of things that you just aren't used to because you haven't had to do it. You haven't had to live in a tight, small space. You haven't had to live in community. And we allow you to transition from a place where you haven't experienced any of that structure, have kind of a middle ground where you have some structure and we teach you how to live within that structure and then move to a place where you no longer need that structure.
That's awesome. That's really a great explanation. That's awesome. I appreciate so much that you've given me your time and expertise and knowledge and experience. It's awesome. And I think it's valuable. And I really want to share it with our community. So, Tabitha, thank you so much. Again, this is Tabitha Allen, who works with the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco and has for many years. This is Coastside Conversations, and we will talk to you later.